Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. After just another relaxing weekend when you could take a break from the news, it's not like Obamacare was suddenly struck down by a federal judge on Friday night on the eve of Saturday's enrollment deadline for 2019, no less. It's not like HUD Secretary Ben Carson issued an ultimatum on Friday night that if NYCHA doesn't get its act together by January 31st, the federal government will take control away from the New York City Housing Authority. It's not like the White House started preparing over the weekend for a partial government shutdown because they and the Congress can't agree on funding for a border wall. It's not like the Senate just voted to get the United States out of a foreign war, something they almost never do. It's not like people are dissecting why another news organization is going under, the conservative but anti-Trump Weekly Standard this time. It's not like WNYC and ProPublica revealed that Trump's company may have tried to price gouge his own presidential inaugural committee on the price of Trump hotel event space, even as the Wall Street Journal revealed on Thursday that there's a federal investigation into whether the committee illegally allowed foreign governments to buy influence with Trump by throwing money at those inauguration events, overpriced though they may have been. And it's not as if Trump appointees and the father of that seven-year-old who died of dehydration in federal custody after crossing from Mexico spent any time this week blaming each other for the little girl's death. No, just another weekend to go shopping before Christmas. Except that all of those things did actually happen in the last few days. We will take them up this morning in three parts. The investigations coming up later. The death of the seven-year-old coming up after that. We will devote an individual segment to that tragedy and how to prevent more like it. And first, right now, the Obamacare ruling and more with views from left and right. We welcome Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine and a Washington Post columnist, and Jim Antle, editor of the American Conservative magazine. Katrina, welcome back, and Jim, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian, for walking us through just another week in American life.
Just another weekend, just another
You didn't even touch on the world. You go broad.
We didn't
The turbulence and the vertigo. But it's living through history. We're living through history, and I think we're so caught up in the tumult and the vortex that sometimes it's just tick-tock, and we're not looking at the broader picture. But you did.
Thank you. And Jim, since you're a first-time guest, I'll give you the courtesy of the first word on the federal judge in Texas declaring all of the Affordable Care Act to be unconstitutional. I want first, before we even get to any conversation about this, to make very clear to our Obamacare-insured listeners that this does not invalidate your current health insurance policies or what you might have just signed up for 2019. It just begins a process of appeals while your policies remain in full effect. So everybody should know that if it applies to you. But still, it's potentially huge. So, Jim, explain the judge's reasoning as you understand it, and tell us to what degree you support it.
Well, there has been an ongoing legal battle over Obamacare, really stretching back to when President Obama was still in office and the law was pretty new. And the view of a lot of conservatives in legal circles was that the important mechanisms of Obamacare, particularly the individual mandate, but other regulations contained in the law, exceed the enumerated powers of the federal government and don't have a clear-cut basis in the Constitution. And federal courts have taken a very mixed view of that argument, and it was largely thought to have conclusively ended, not in the academic and political sense, that will obviously be debated forever, but after the Supreme Court, with John Roberts' pivotal vote, upheld the Affordable Care Act about 8 or so years ago. It was, I think, considered, or about 6, I think, years ago. It was considered, I think, by most people to be a settled legal question with the courts, at least. But the challenges continued. And this latest ruling is not confined to the individual mandate, which was technically stripped by the tax bill that was passed by the Republican Congress, signed into law by President Trump. In effect, at least, you know, sort of gutted the individual mandate. This says that the law in its entirety is unconstitutional, would throw the whole thing out. Now, just because that happened in this particular court doesn't mean that that would necessarily be upheld on appeal, and I think it's actually pretty unlikely that we'll see such a broad ruling be upheld on appeal. But, you know, you never know. And if it wends all the way to the Supreme Court's composition is a little bit different than it was the last time they ruled on it. You have Neil Gorsuch and you have Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who are, you know, Gorsuch isn't much of a move to the right from Antonin Scalia, who he replaced. But Kavanaugh is perhaps at least incrementally to the right of Justice Anthony Kennedy, so who was a skeptic of Obamacare. So, you know, there's a lot going on here legally, but it's coming in the context of a time where the politics of Obamacare, which had been pretty favorable to Republicans, I think, until this last election cycle, seems to have moved more in favor of the Democrats. We're concerned about pre-existing conditions where the support for the Medicaid expansion contained in the Affordable Care Act. These things seem to play in favor of Democrats, and it's now Republicans who are seen as the disruptors of people's existing health care arrangements, which tends to be a precarious position to be in politically whenever you're seen as the disruptor of the health care status quo.
So there's some of the politics and some of the law. Here's a clip from NPR's Morning Edition just a few hours ago of Ezekiel Emanuel, one of the architects of Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, saying why he thinks it's legally ridiculous to throw out the whole law just because the tax penalty for the mandate is gone. It's because the law includes so many provisions that are irrelevant to that. You'll hear him argue and give some examples.
It's a small part of the law. There's many other things in the law where the mandate has no effect, like changes to how we pay doctors, changes to try to incentivize improved quality, penalties to hospitals that have too many hospital-acquired infections and other problems. Those things have nothing to do with the mandate. So the judge here is just way overstepping in his decision.
Ezekiel Emanuel this morning. But Katrina, I was looking at your Twitter feed this morning, and it looks like there's a range of degrees of concern among progressives about whether, despite that litany of things that are completely irrelevant to the ruling, when it goes up the chain, the Supreme Court might uphold this ruling anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I tweeted that, you know, there are a lot of people, friends, colleagues who may try to downplay this decision. It's raw judicial activism. It's totally unsound logic. It will be appealed. But, you know, it does highlight in stark relief how hard-won progressive gains remain vulnerable due to the fact the courts have been seated, taken by the Republicans, often in raw judicial activist ways. I mean, I think Jim laid out some of the legal issues. It is the case that Congress specifically declined to strike down the ACA in 2017 when it chose to alter only one portion of the bill. I think Emanuel was referring to that. It's also ironic in light of the political climate. We've just come out of a midterm where the defense of people, protections for people with pre-existing conditions, was at the front and center of Democrats' pitch to the American people. And so many Republicans, including President Trump, fudged, if I can be polite, about their signals on that. So we have disruption. I think it will wend its way through the court. It is the case, Brian, you were right to, you know, notify people. This was... The judge didn't issue an injunction, meaning that in the short term nothing will change. But I do think in the long term it empowers another idea issue Democrats, progressives have made their own as we enter what I call the ideas primary toward 2020, which is Medicare for all. And there are many different layers and levels and plans, but I think it highlights again the instability of Obamacare, which, by the way, you know, used to be called Romneycare, named for the former governor of Massachusetts. It did have some roots in Heritage Foundation plans. It's not the be-all and end-all, and I think it should give impetus to the majority support for Medicare for All of a certain kind as we've, you know, worked that out. This decision, as Jim said, is terribly disruptive, and I don't think we want to lose sight of the human lives it endangers, it disrupts. But it was stunning coming on a Friday out of Texas, and we have to take it seriously.
Jim, as Katrina sees from the left an opportunity for Medicare for All to gain political traction as a result of the threat to Obamacare that this ruling represents, I wonder how you see from the right what President Trump's reaction to this court ruling was over the weekend, which was to be kind of bipartisan and conciliatory and saying, you know, I want Obamacare thrown out, but I also want great health care for Americans, and I know the Democrats do too. And he was suggesting, you know, maybe with the incoming Democratic majority in the House, there's an opportunity for some kind of common ground on some kind of new kind of health care system. I presume from his point of view, it would not be Medicare for All. He's made conciliatory noises like that on other issues and then, you know, backed off into a hardcore stance of defiance. But what do you see here as any potential political opportunity, if any?
Well, President Trump has always been a little bit of a wild card in this debate because on the one hand, he's committed to Obamacare repeal as a Republican agenda item and as something that both he and the party more broadly had promised Republican voters that they would do. So he has always wanted to be able to say that he's delivered on that promise, but at the same time, he's not as ideological about healthcare policy or about many other policies as a lot of Republicans in Congress are. So he doesn't share the same deep-seated philosophical objections and constitutional objections to the law and to its policy goals that I think a lot of his colleagues within the party and even within the administration do. So he's always wanted to sort of say that he could craft some kind of Trump care. We don't know what exactly that would look like. He's been very critical of Medicare for All, but he's been a single payer supporter in his past. I think that the problem has been whenever he has tried to do these sorts of compromises where he deviates from Republican orthodoxy, because he is not filling in the details with any policy specifics himself, the Democrats don't really know what to do in terms of offering him an olive branch because they're sort of negotiating with this moving target. And it's hard for him to sway Republicans because Republicans don't really know where to go following his lead either. Mm-hmm. And then you have a core group, I think, of committed conservatives who won't necessarily want to sign on to Romney Care or to, you know, because I think there is, as Medicare for All increases in popularity, especially among Democrats, there's going to be a temptation, I think, among Republicans to begin defending something like Obamacare, because Obamacare will be to the right of Medicare for All. That, frankly, is how we got Romney Care, and that's why Stuart Butler at the Heritage Foundation was tinkering with the individual mandate, was because the individual mandate was seen as something that was to the right of the employer mandate that was going to be contained in Hillary Clinton's health care plans. But Republican positioning on health care policy has tended to be very reactive to whatever the Democrats mm-hmm. are doing. So they either will support a watered-down version of the Democrat plan, or they will be in opposition to whatever the Democratic plan is. But their own policy on it has never really been nailed down.
So, Katrina, one more thing on this before we move on to some other issues. We had on the show last week a few of the incoming Democratic House freshmen from our area, and one of them suggested that maybe a place where, in all practicality, they could actually move on health care, and this was before the ruling, but I think it probably still would stand as this person's opinion, is that Medicare for All is not practically feasible to get through Congress at this time, but what might be is a buy-in to Medicare for people over 50. Because that's the most vulnerable population for unaffordable health care, a buy-in to Medicare for people over 50 until full Medicare age. What do you think about that idea?
I think it's important that the new incoming members, along with those in the House, and by the way, the Congressional Progressive Caucus is in line to chair 13 committees. It's the largest values-based caucus in the House. The important thing will be to connect much-needed oversight of the Trump administration to a bold policy vision that frames a clear choice for voters, not just heading into 2020, but generally. And I think that proposal, Brian, is part of what incoming Democrats, progressives, are thinking of, and they'll be creative. Won't pass, but lay it down. Build markers. Build what is support, by the way, not just the left, Brian. Medicare for All, increasingly, particularly buy-in at age 50, is a common-sense proposal that more and more Americans, majorities of, support. So I think it's very important. I mean, what Jim said about Republicans, pretty kind. I think they've made a mantra of opposing Obamacare. I mean, how many times did they vote against it? It seems that Schumer, Senate Minority Leader Schumer, is going to join Speaker Pelosi in making Democrats part of an appeal around this upending of the ACA. Let Trump, if he wants to show how heretical he is, join with them. Put a vote on the floor. Urge an intervention in the case. But we know the Senate will remain in Republican control, and I think Jim laid out, again, pretty kindly, how this is an awkward juggling act for the Republican Party, you know, as they pretended to support pre-existing condition protection. But the perception and reality is the GOP is threatening insurance that covers nearly 20 million Americans and an expansion of Medicaid. But I do think it's going to be interesting to see how this younger, not just younger, but more progressive generation of House members works with this issue. And I think that is viable and practical in the short term, certainly.
My guests on WNYC are Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation, and Jim Antle, editor of the American Conservative magazine. And I'd like to turn next to an area where I think the two of you may agree, which is the Senate vote on Friday to limit or end the U.S. role backing Saudi Arabia in its war in Yemen, which is also a humanitarian disaster for the Yemeni people. The U.S. Right. position has been that it's necessary to stop Iran's side from winning the war in Yemen, which would be much worse for the world. So, Katrina, I'll start with you on this one. What changed here, and what do you think of it?
I think it's extraordinarily important that Congress has taken this critical step toward reasserting its war powers control. You know, 45 years after War Powers Act was passed, the Senate took this important step, and it happened over the last year or so, Brian, as a number of bold, courageous legislators, Bernie Sanders, Chris Murphy, Senator from Connecticut, Representative Ro Khanna from California, joined by a handful of Republicans, have worked tirelessly to compel Congress to end this U.S.-made horrific humanitarian crisis in Yemen, which the United States has been deeply complicit in. It's also taken the work of movements outside of Congress, whether it's you know, Code Pink or Win Without War Peace Action. So I think it's finally, of course, it took the horrific killing of the journalist, the Saudi journalist Khashoggi, to, I think, make it a tipping point. Because until then, progressive lawmakers led by Murphy, Sanders, Khanna, joined by a handful of Republicans, have been hampered time and again by not only other Democrats' indifference, but Republicans' insidiousness and the bipartisan foreign policy establishment's stubborn insistence on treating an immoral Saudi regime as an indispensable ally. So it's been about a two-year process, and I think we're seeing something very important that I do believe is of transpartisan importance, as I call it. I do think the nation and the American conservative believe in restraint, believe in Congress playing a role, checking the executive, whoever the executive is, and returning these powers of war and peace control to Congress.
Jim, left-right confluence on this?
Yeah, I think among serious constitutional conservatives, both in Congress and outside of it, there's no question that Congress has abdicated, to put it nicely, its duty and role over war and peace. They've really punted all of these questions to the executive branch, which is not the way things are structured under the Constitution. And on top of the legal and procedural problems with this, the actual policies that we've been pursuing with all of these presidential wars have been disastrous in result. And Yemen is no exception to that. It's a humanitarian catastrophe where we have enough involvement to prolong human suffering in Yemen, but not enough involvement that it is widely recognized by the American people that we're engaged and this is even going on. So it's been able to really continue for quite some time. And I think, yes, the Khashoggi murder certainly and the Trump administration's sort of blasé response to it was a real tipping point, I think, both in terms of the public really starting to realize that there was something amiss in our relationship with Saudi Arabia, and also on Capitol Hill, because you had this core group of sort of Mike Lee, Rand Paul-type conservatives and a committed group of progressive Democrats who have always been calling into question this policy. But it was very difficult to get sort of your centrist Democrats and Republicans interested in this at all. And certainly the Republican leadership had no interest in it whatsoever. And I think Khashoggi was a tipping point, certainly on Capitol Hill. And hopefully, we had a good vote in the Senate. House, we're not quite so fortunate. So hopefully in the next year, we can really see some progress on this issue.
Jim, what about
Speaker Pelosi, forgive me, Brian.
Please.
I've heard that Speaker Pelosi will put up in the new session of the House a war powers resolution and drive to have it supported by a majority.
Jim, what about the conservative concern about Iran's power in the Middle East and the argument that may go beyond what a lot of Democrats would make, that the U.S. has a responsibility to flex its military muscles to stop Iran or things will be worse than they are?
You know, I reject the idea that we need to begin to repeat the mistakes that we made in Iraq vis-a-vis Iran, which is, I think, a position taken by a lot of the people who unfortunately are in important advisory roles to President Trump on these issues. I think that it is a departure from the America First platform on which he ran. I think one of the better things that he campaigned on and one of the few things that he had in common with former President Obama is that they both recognized that there was something wrong with our post-Cold War foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East. But the Trump administration is very committed to making Iran the top adversary now in the Middle East, and that has caused them to lean very heavily towards Saudi Arabia. They really view Saudi Arabia as an important check on Iran and the region, and therefore they've given the Saudis a blank check on things like Yemen, and I don't personally think it's defensible.
Which brings us in a way to our next topic, which is the demise of another news organization, the conservative Weekly Standard, which was kind of founded on the idea of promoting war in Iraq, a disaster in so many people's eyes, and recently was conservative but anti-Trump. And Katrina, funny enough, I think you might be more wistful about this conservative magazine's demise than Jim is, you think?
Wistful would not be the word, Brian. Here's my thinking. I disagreed with most in the Weekly Standard. I think the decision to take this country into war in Iraq, which the Weekly Standard in so many ways played a deep, fundamental, abiding role, was one of the great disasters of this country's history, certainly in issues of war and peace. While I disagreed with most in the Weekly Standard over its two decades, I have to say, as editor-publisher of The Nation, marking 153 years, I believe in this culture of clickbait, of homogenization of views, of conglomeratization. I believe magazines of opinion are an essential source for the political ideas and debates that shape and confront our country. So in that sense, I think, it's also a measure of the intolerance in the Trump world that you can't keep a publication like the Weekly Standard standing and moving. I suspect if it's true that the owners of the Weekly Standard refuse to sell it to a group of investors, that really is, ugly. But I think Mr. Crystal, who I am no fan of, I believe he was one of the chief architects of taking us into the war in Iraq, or the editor Stephen Hayes, likely to find a group of people who want to continue the voice of the Weekly Standard. Because, as I said, I think places like The Nation, like the American Conservative, like the New Republic, like the Weekly Standard, have a role in our culture of reasoned debate, though sometimes not so reasoned on some sides, but it's a measure. There should be room in Trump world. And I will tell you, at The Nation, where, you know, we were one of the very few liberal progressive publications to oppose the war in Iraq, we didn't take a hit. It's interesting. Our circulation grew threefold. So I think, you know, it shows something's going on in the culture. Social media may be playing a role, but my basic line is what I just shared.
And Jim, we should tell the listeners that you worked until recently for the Washington Examiner,
right,
another conservative publication owned by the same parent company that owned the Weekly Standard. Is the lesson for you that there is no conservatism left in this country, except among a few elites like William Kristol, that isn't full Trump nationalist?
No, I wouldn't say that. And look, I have come to this from a very interesting vantage point. So I started my career at the American Conservative and left and went on to various other places, which took me to sharing offices with the Weekly Standard at the Washington Examiner. And there was a sort of, even though the publications were diametrically opposed on the Iraq War, and many other issues, by the time I was at the Examiner, the Weekly Standard had a feel to it that was a little eerily reminiscent of what TAC was like in the Bush years. So you have these conservative
TAC
magazines,
being the American
conservative.
Yes,
I'm sorry. You have these conservative magazines that have no use for the Republican president of the United States. I think a big difference was that the American Conservative was founded as an insurgent publication that was challenging some dominant narratives on the right, and the initial subscribers knew that that was what they would be getting, and the initial people who were supporting it financially knew that that was what they were financially supporting. I think in the case of the Weekly Standard, it was a magazine that was to have influence on Republicans in the Beltway and also outside of it. And I think for them to then scale down from being a sort of the in-flight magazine of Air Force One under George W. Bush to sort of more of a resistance posture under Trump was a little bit more difficult, and maybe made the financial supporters reevaluate whether the Standard's brand could really have the same effect that it had had in previous administrations.
The
whether that proves short-sighted or not remains to be seen.
The in-flight magazine of Air Force One for George W. Bush. We'll write that one down. Last topic this week. As most people know by now, we have a partial government shutdown looming by Saturday if the President and Congress can't get to yes on some kind of deal around Trump's insistence on border wall funding, or if one side backs down. I want to play a clip of Trump's top aide on this issue, Stephen Miller, on CBS Face the Nation yesterday, in which he says very directly where Trump and his core supporters are coming from on this, and we'll get both your takes before we run out of time.
We're going to do whatever is necessary to build the border wall to stop this ongoing crisis of illegal immigration.
And that means
if it comes to it, absolutely. This is a very fundamental issue. At stake is the question of whether or not the United States remains a sovereign country, whether or not we can establish and enforce rules for entrance into our country. The Democrat Party is a simple choice. They can either choose to fight for America's working class or to promote illegal immigration. You can't do both.
Our position as a sovereign country is at stake, from migrants who would characterize their own situation as, you know, seeking a port in a storm. White House advisor Stephen Miller there with Margaret Brennan on Face the Nation. Jim, how close is that to your own position as a conservative?
Well, I don't know that I'd do a government shutdown over this, and I don't think the border wall is the best way to control immigration, but I do share the basic concern that there seems to be an argument that affluent countries should not be able to control their own borders and sovereignty. I think the Trump administration was emboldened by the fact that they, uncharacteristically for Republicans, won, quote-unquote, on a government shutdown over DACA earlier in the year, which, you know, Republicans, no matter whether they're controlling Congress or controlling the White House, tend to lose government shutdown battles. And this was a rare win, even on an immigration issue where President Trump's position didn't actually poll very well. Red state Democrats in the Senate still capitulated to his position. I don't think they're in quite the same position here. But I think that is why Trump not only seems to be willing to do this shutdown when he's backed down from it before, but he's very clearly in his conversation with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer decided to take ownership of it in a way that could very easily be played back at him in television and radio commercials later.
Katrina, where do you want to start on this?
This is Trump's shutdown. He said, I claim the mantle. I want it. He's doubling down. The political manipulation factor is he is doing it for his base. The hundreds of miles of existing barriers at the border haven't stopped the flow of immigrants. We need a humane, comprehensive immigration reform. The most effective long-term way to tackle the migrant problem is to do so at the source in Central America. And there's a very interesting proposal on offer from the new Mexican president, Lopez Obrador, who was sworn in December 1, a kind of Marshall Plan for Central America. You've got to go to the root. At the moment, we're looking at tragedy. We're looking at horror. Seven-year-old girl from Guatemala, Brian, dies of dehydration and shock after she was taken into Border Patrol custody last week. I mean, are we going to see more of this? This lack of accountability and a culture of cruelty within Border Patrol have exacerbated policies that lead to migrant deaths and have done little, if anything, to deal with the migrant situation, which is made hyped up by Stephen Miller, who's a true believer in the ugliest sense, and President Trump, who talks about criminals and others coming across the border, the caravan of Middle East, terrorists. I mean, you have got a seven-year-old girl dead, and you got no humane, comprehensive plan. I do think Democrats need to turn to this, lifting up the benefits and power of immigration, but coming back to plans and policies and programs, not letting Trump dictate. But I think if there is a shutdown, you know, the lives of workers, who I believe he's betrayed in other ways, will be on his back if there is a shutdown, because he claimed it in that confrontational, crazy meeting with Schumer and Pelosi.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation and a Washington Post columnist, and Jim Antle, now the editor of the American Conservative magazine. Thank you both so much for starting us off today.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Later in the program, in about a half hour, we will do a separate segment on the death of that seven-year-old just across, you know, who had just crossed from Mexico into the United States. Coming up next, we'll talk to former Watergate prosecutor Jill Wine Banks about some of the issues in the investigations. There are so many, you can't tell the players without a scorecard. We'll try to unpack a few of the things that are going on right now. Stay with us.